Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to Be Bold America. I'm your host, Jill Cody, along with my co-host, Dr. Pettis Perry. Hey, Pettis, how are things up north in Bellingham, Washington today?
Well, they're wet. They're a little bit chilly, but absolutely beautiful.
Oh, well, Washington is a beautiful state. And, you know, I don't think we've ever told our listeners that, you know, you're a professor with Walden University, and I think you did 7 webinars this week?
Not this week, but during July and August on 7 strategies for organizational effectiveness.
Ah, okay. Well, you know, you do have a full-time job up there, I know. Was it grading papers?
But I love being here with you.
Oh, and I love having you here, too. Pettis, why don't you introduce our program topic today?
I sure will. Thank you, Jill. Our program today is the end of white Christian America. From most of our country's history, white Christian America, a cultural and political identity built primarily by white Protestant Christians, sets the tone for our national policy and shapes the American ideals. But in recent decades, this has changed. Drawing on findings from one of the largest troves of surveyed data on contemporary politics and religion, Robert Jones shows how today's most heated political controversies can be understood only in the context of the anxieties that white Christians feel as the racial, religious, and cultural landscape changes around them. Looking ahead, Jones forecasts the way that white Christians might adjust to their new reality and the consequences for us all if they don't. Our future depends on it. Jill, back to you. Why don't you now introduce our guest?
I am honored to introduce Robert P. Jones, who is the CEO and founder of Public Religion Research Institute. He is the author of The End of White Christian America, which won the 2019 Grawemeyer Award in Religion. He's also the author of White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity, that won the 2021 American Book Award. Robert writes regularly on politics, culture, and religion for The Atlantic Online, NBC Think, and other outlets. He is frequently featured in major national media such as CNN, MSNBC, NPR, The New York Times, and The Washington Post. Welcome to Be Bold America, Robert.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
We are delighted that you're here. Before we begin talking about white Christian America and maybe its end, our interview with you today is really timely. Didn't you just launch the results of your 2021 American Values Survey just this past Monday? And what did you learn? And what were some of the findings that surprised you?
We did, yes. Thank you for that. This past Monday, we released in partnership with the Brookings Institution, PRRI's 12th Annual American Value Survey. Just as we're first talking, so PRRI, for your listeners, PRRI is an organization I founded 12 years ago. We are a nonpartisan, nonprofit, independent research organization. And this survey was based on an interview with over 2,500 Americans. And along the themes that you were introducing here, we found that this deep, deep cultural anxiety is still very much with us today, and is very much shaping, you know, our politics. And one of the more kind of divisive questions that divides us right down the middle is, for example, a question about how the country is changing. Is it changing for the better or for the worse? This will set the table, I think, pretty well. We asked Americans whether American culture has changed for the better or for the worse since the 1950s. Now, this is obviously prior to Brown v. Board of Education and desegregation and the Civil Rights Movement. And it turns out that question divides the country right in half. And we find it puts our two political parties on very opposite ends of the fence, with more than 6 in 10 Democrats saying it's changed for the better, more than 6 in 10 Republicans saying it's changed for the worse, and white Christian groups, all in majority, saying things have changed for the worse since the 1950s. But non-white Christian groups and non-Christian religious groups, religiously unaffiliated Americans, all on the other side saying things have changed for the better.
Well, what were some of the findings that surprised you this year?
Well, you know, I think one that has kind of ricocheted around the media this week, including landing me on CNN twice with Jake Tapper and Don Lemon, was quite a disturbing finding, in fact, that we found when we asked about the past election, more than 3 in 10 Americans still today, despite there being no evidence for this, believe that the 2020 election was stolen from Donald Trump. And then maybe even more disturbing than that, we found that of that group, 39% of them believe that agree with this statement, that true American patriots may have to resort to violence to save the country. And even if we just look at the partisans, we found that 30% of Republicans, among all Republicans, in fact, believe that true American patriots may have to resort to violence to save the country, versus only 11% of Democrats. So when you think about, you know, this is a major political party, and 3 in 10 really believe that violence may be justified to achieve a political outcome. I mean, it's a troubling place to be.
Well, I don't know how violence is ever justified, so it is sort of shocking. I visited the website recently, and I saw that you have the results of your American Values Survey right there at the homepage, if listeners are interested in learning more. Pettis, did you have a question to start with as well?
I do, but a comment first. The question really becomes, better for whom? I was alive in the 50s, so I know what segregation looks like. I believe that I have many more freedoms, although I do have a high degree of concern for how we're heading towards violence. And potentially, if this doesn't get under control, another civil war. But this has been propagated by the people on the right. They were talking prior to the last election, the 2016 election, that if things didn't go their way, they were going to exercise their Second Amendment rights. So I think that this could all be predicted. I'm very interested in your findings because it puts the data in a way that people can really digest it and see it. So thank you for the work that you do.
Thank you.
You're quite welcome. I'm very intrigued by the work that you're doing, by the way. I have a very basic question. So are we talking about Christians, or are we talking, and I understand from the materials that I've read that we're talking about primarily Protestants, if I understand you correctly. But are we talking about Christians, evangelical Christians? You know, we're seeing some ethnic minorities, even though they might be a few in Trump rallies, sitting behind him in the key photo place. So what are your thoughts about that?
No, it's a really important question. The first book you mentioned, The End of White Christian America, it was a book that came out in 2016, and so it was actually out, you know, prior to Trump, actually, and the book was completed prior to Trump even being a candidate for president in 2016. But I could see what I was trying to put my finger on there and to put a lens on was this coalescing of white ethnic identity and Christian identity together into a political force that was becoming quite formidable and coalescing really inside the Republican Party. So, for example, today, the Republican Party today is about 7 in 10 white and Christian. Now, about half of that 7 in 10, about a third of Republicans are just white evangelical Protestants. But it's not just that group. You know, if you look at really the religious landscape and voting patterns over the past several decades, really since Reagan in the 1980s, you could fairly accurately summarize the voting patterns of Americans by race and religion this way. And that is that majorities of white Christians, and that includes white evangelicals, white non-evangelical Protestants, and white Catholics, tend to vote majority Republican. and pretty much everyone else, non-white Christians, non-Christian religious people, Jews, Hindus, Muslims, Buddhists, etc., and religiously unaffiliated Americans tend to vote majority for Democrats. So it's worth noting that in 2016 and in 2020, everybody knows that white evangelical Protestants voted about 8 and 10 or more. It's actually 81%, and 2016 even went up to 84% in 2020 voted for Trump. But what I think most people don't know is that the other two major white Christian groups, that is white non-evangelical Protestants, sometimes called mainline Protestants, that tend to be thought of as more progressive, voted nearly 6 and 10. For Donald Trump, and white Catholics also voted about 6 and 10 for Donald Trump. So it really that I think is the new thing that I've been trying to draw attention to, and really in both books is the way that racial and particularly white racial identity, there's really an ethno-religious political identity that has kind of come to have a lot of salience among these groups and is really driving a lot of political activity today and really driving the divisions between our two political parties.
This past September, you wrote an article titled The Unmaking of the White Christian Worldview, and I would think some of it's based on your book, The End of White Christian America, but in it, you talked about your white working class background and the end or the crumbling of white Christian America and how it has unleashed remarkably destructive forces into American life. Robert, can you tell us about your background and why this crumbling of the white Christian worldview is destroying so much of our democracy?
In my day job, I kind of wear a social scientist hat at PRRI. And do have a PhD in religion, but this is also a world that I in which I grew up. So I grew up Southern Baptist, which is the largest evangelical Protestant denomination in the country, in Mississippi. And my family, both sides, my father and my mother's family, I should say also I'm white, and both my mother and my father's family go back six generations into Middle Georgia. So deep, deep roots in the deep, deep South. And so this was a world that kind of I knew, I grew up in, and I was also that kid who was at church all the time, even all through my teenage years, was, you know, active in the youth group. I was there like literally 5 days a week, no kidding. And so it was a world I was deeply immersed in, went to Southern Baptist College, I have a degree from a Southern Baptist seminary. As well. So drink pretty deeply at that well. And I think one of the things that's become clear is that there, you know, we have reached a point where I think two things have gone on. Like one of the biggest things is the changing demographics of the country. And they've changed fairly quickly. And this has led to a kind of identity crisis, I think, among many white Christians in the country who really believe that the country was, you know, created to be literally a promised land for Christians of European descent. And so as the country has begun to change, that clearly is no longer a tenable thing to think, it really has created a kind of crisis. If we look at the demographics, as recently as 2008, when Barack Obama was running for president, the country was still majority white and Christian. It was 54% white and Christian. When I wrote The End of White Christian America, I was drawing attention to the fact that it had dropped from 54% to 47%. So below majority, and that number is 44% today. So it's continued to drop. So between 2008 and today, it's gone from 54% to 44%. So we've gone from being a majority, demographically speaking, a majority white Christian country to one that is no longer a white Christian country. And I think the other piece of this that is key is that white evangelicals themselves have begun to shrink and age as a group over this last decade. So they've gone from being in that same period about a little more than 1 in 5 Americans down. So they were 21% of Americans down to 14.5. Percent of Americans, and their median age has gone up from 52 to 57. So they're shrinking and graying. And I think this has, again, I think the kind of loss of political or demographic dominance and this seeing the writing on the wall, I think, really, of the country changing has created this visceral reaction that is literally an identity crisis, and I think it's led to a kind of desperate set of activities that have abandoned principle and have resorted to kind of an ends justify the means kind of political ethic.
You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM, many voices, one station. Listen globally online from the KSQD.org website. We're speaking with Robert P. Jones, who is the CEO and founder of the Public Religion Research Institute. You may learn more about Robert and PRRI by visiting PRRI.org. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
Hello, K-Squid listeners. I'm Todd Hartman, and each weekday at 4 p.m., I bring you a different perspective on the news than you're likely to hear on most media outlets. Please join me on KSQD Santa Cruz, your ink spot on the dial for the Tom Hartman program, heard now for the first time ever in the Monterey Bay Area at 90.7 FM, weekdays at 4 p.m. That's Progressive Talking Conversation with me, Tom Hartman, weekdays at 4 p.m. on KSQD 90.7 FM. Tag, you're it.
Today, our topic is the end of white Christian America, and we're speaking with Robert P. Jones, who is the CEO and founder of the Public Religion Research Institute, and I hope you will join me in receiving the Institute's daily morning buzz by visiting PRRI.org. Pettis, over to you.
Thank you. Your company has been around for 12 years, if I remember correctly. So when did you begin to see the shift in this identity crisis? I remember reading something, I think it was prior to the 2016 election, that referenced a report that came out around 2012 or 14. I think it was one of the government data reports. It might have been an FBI report. Was that when this wake-up and crisis, identity crisis began, or do you have some other time point of reference?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. You know, I really think that what we're experiencing right now is the end and the very kind of effervescent end of a much longer arc. In fact, I mean, when I look back to kind of where this begins and like, you know, think about like where the country might have taken a different turn. You know, I really think the roots of our kind of partisan polarization today that is all around race and religion and American identity really has its roots in reactions to the civil rights movement. So it you know, if we, again, I'll kind of tie it to my own family's history here. I mean, you know, my grandparents living in middle Georgia were prior to the 1960s all Democrats, right? They were white conservative Democrats from the South, and thought of themselves as Dixiecrats. They were against the desegregation of schools, very much aligned with, you know, the kind of really a kind of Confederate mindset that was kind of wrapped up with white supremacy, to be the most blunt about it. And what happened was, you know, as soon as the Democratic Party became identified as the party backing civil rights with the Voting Rights Act and Civil Rights Act of 1964 and 1965, you began to see literally a white Christian flight from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party. It takes until about Reagan, so about 15 years for that migration really to be complete, but that's pretty fast in terms of you know, these kinds of things happening. But between, you know, 65 and 80, really you see this. There's a great book called The Rise of the Republican South that really documents this, that you just see this massive shift, and it's really tied up with a disaffected whites moving from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party, and this long Southern strategy that the Republican Party, you know, really embarked on. I mean, the Republican Party itself has admitted that it embarked on this, and that was ginning up racial resentment among whites in the South, and particularly white Christians in the South, and holding up this vision of the country really as a white Christian country, any policy that didn't fit that was something that got opposed. So I really think that the table was set long before, you know, like I think a lot of times everybody thinks that, or the temptation is to think that, you know, Donald Trump walked onto the stage and everything changed. But I think the stage was set. You really think of, take that metaphor seriously. The props were there. The scenery had been painted. And I think Donald Trump was just simply very adroit at exploiting the stage that he walked on. But that stage had been built for decades, had been being built for decades.
Jill, if I might.
Yes, go ahead, Pettis.
Just as a point of reference, I grew up in an interracial family who were civil rights activists. My entire family has been involved in one form or another, fighting for civil rights for people. So hearing your, first of all, I'm very glad you stated what you stated, because you talked about the chronology and how actually the Dixiecrats became the Republican Party around that civil rights, those civil rights decisions, because they began to lose a grip. And I'm also very thankful for you for identifying the Southern strategy. It's something that I've talked about quite a bit in my own work. So I'm very happy that you've done that. I think people who are having this identity crisis, and in my world, we talk about it as cognitive dissonance. And I think on this, at this level, it's cognitive dissonance on steroids. That was really propelled, from my perspective anyway, to a large extent, with the election of Barack Obama. On the evening of his election, the pundits were saying that, you know, we no longer have a problem with race in America. And then I heard Mitch McConnell come on and say, we're going to do everything we can to make him a one-term president. First thing in the morning, I turned on C-SPAN. The first thing that I heard, the first caller, was there will never be an N-word in the White House. The second call that I heard that morning was Barack Obama is the Antichrist. And so all of the pent-up issues that the very people you're talking about began to surface and began to take on a momentum of their own. And we can see this now. The whole idea of critical race theory is an inconvenient truth for white supremacists because it undermines their claim to this idea of legitimacy and privilege that they have been propagating much before the Civil War. I mean, these issues go back to the Three-Fifths Compromise, and you know, and I think you're right to talk about the foundation for what's happening today. So what are your thoughts as we look at the larger picture of what's going on today and what we can do about it to begin to change the course of our history? Because at this point, we have control over what's going to happen with our history.
Well, why don't we save the what we can do about it for our keep, stop, start section later on in the show? But go ahead.
Well, let me, so I can put a pin in that, but let me just extend it back even further, because I really think it's important for us to get the scale of the problem in front of us. The version of Christianity that lands on these shores, that we, this piece of land we now call the United States of America, came predominantly from Western Europe, and it was predicated on the idea of domination, right? That Christianity and the state and kind of went to hand in hand together, and land acquisition, and it's actually built on it's really something that I have all this kind of religious education in my background, and I was never taught what was perhaps the most central doctrine that governed the public face of Christianity for several hundred years was called the doctrine of discovery. And it was something that really came together in 1493. That year will sound familiar to listeners because of the thing that many of us were taught about 1492, right? Columbus discovering America supposedly in 1492. But it's no coincidence that the very next year, Spain asked the Pope, the head of the Western Church, to validate its claims. And what basically ended up happening then is there was a series of papal edicts that made official Western European Christian doctrine that basically said that if any kind of explorers from Western Europe encounter people who are not Christian, that they have the blessing of the church and are backed by the power of state to seize those lands and dominate those people, and that they have the blessing of God to do that. And that was central Christian doctrine that was part of, you know, this whole idea of America as a new Zion and, you know, manifest destiny is all built on this Christian doctrine that was very explicit, not just something kind of in the background. And yet it's most something that most certainly most white Christians today know nothing about. But we're really talking about dismantling something that old, you know, but it's a very simple idea at the end of the day, right? It's this idea that, again, you know, that people who practice the Christian faith and can trace their lineage to be of European descent, you know, have the blessing of God to dominate everyone else. And that really is what has driven much of American history. So we're really talking about undoing something very deep. I think the good news is that if you say it that explicitly, most people recoil. Even white Christians tend to recoil from that. But yet, I think taking that seriously and learning how to dismantle it, we can talk about that a little bit later, but I think that's the crux of the problem, is to finally live out a faith and live out a version of citizenship that doesn't have white supremacy, this idea that white lives are more valuable than others, baked into it.
Well, I think this is a good time to take a break because all of our questions are so intense. And we'll just, you're listening to our guest, Robert P. Jones, CEO of PRRI, who is frequently featured in major national media such as CNN, MSNBC, NPR, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and on KSQD's Be Bold America. Many voices, one station. In addition, if you'd like to be added to our news group, you may text Be Bold America to 22828. Text Be Bold America to 22828. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
Ralph Waldo Emerson told about a guest who came to dinner and spent the entire evening prattling about his own integrity. The louder he talked of his honor, Emerson wrote, the faster we counted our spoons. Today, America has not one but six guests in our national home babbling about their integrity. They are the six extremist Republican judges who now control our Supreme Court, and it's a bit unsettling to hear them go on and on, almost frantically pleading with us to believe in their judicial impartiality. For example, the court's newest member, Amy Coney Barrett, suddenly blurted out at a public forum in September that, quote, this court is not comprised of a bunch of partisan hacks. Whoa, better count our spoons. In fact, each of the six were installed on the court by right-wing Republicans specifically because they had proven to be devout partisan hacks. Interestingly, Barrett made her unprompted and strained assertion of judicial integrity at the McConnell Center, named for Mitch McConnell, the rabidly partisan GOP senator who pulled a fast one last year, rushing Barrett onto the bench on a party-line vote just before the Republicans lost control of the Senate. Indeed, old Mitch himself introduced Barrett at the forum where she gave her "We Are Not Partisan Hacks" speech. He grinned proudly at the pure hackery of his partisan protege. This is Jim Hightower saying, another hardcore partisan on the court, Sam Alito, whined in October that critics accused the court's GOP majority of being, quote, a dangerous cabal that resorts to sneaky and improper methods to get its way. Well, golly, Sam, yes, we do think that. Because again and again, you partisans sneak up on the Constitution and we the people to twist the law to fit your political bias and personal whims. If you don't want to be considered political hacks, stop being political hacks. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is brought to you by the Lowdown Happy Hour, live streamed from the Chat and Chew Cafe. Details at HightowerLowdown.org.
If you're just joining us, I'm your host, Jill Cody, here with my co-host, Dr. Pettis Perry. You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Listen globally online from the KSQD.org website. We're speaking with Robert P. Jones, who is the CEO and founder of the Public Religion Research Institute. Learn more by visiting their website, PRRI.org. Now, Robert, we were talking before the break about what's laid the foundation for where we are today. And I have said many times on this program that I don't know how we're going to save our Democratic Republic without dealing with the hard truth about Fox News. Roger Ailes, you know, looked at politics and journalism as another way to monetize, you know, to monetize politics. And he literally said, we have no obligation to tell the viewer anything not to our advantage. And he also said, viewers don't want to be informed, they just want to feel informed. So what are your views about Fox as well as the other right-wing media and EWTN that the nonprofit Faithful America has called the Fox News of American Catholicism?
Yeah, well, it's exactly right that media influence has been quite dramatic. And you can see the effect of trust in Fox News, trust in further right news outlets such as Newsmax, OANN. In fact, it's so notable that we can actually measure it in the data. So one of the things we've started doing in the last few years is trying to get measures of how particularly Republicans are stratified here, and so it's just to give you a few you know ideas here. So when we ask about some questions about American identity, or I'll actually start with the election, the ones we've already opened with, the belief where the election, the 2020 presidential election, was stolen for Donald Trump. Again, despite there's no evidence of anything that would justify such a claim, we find that 68% of Republicans believe the 2020 election was stolen. This is data we just released this past Monday. But even within that group, though, you can see the effect of Fox News. So, for example, it's 68% of Republicans overall. But if you look among the subset of Republicans who most trust Fox News, that number rises to 82%. And if you look among the subset of Republicans who trust further right news sources such as Newsmax or OANN, it goes to 97% percent who believe the election was stolen from Donald Trump. And on the issue of violence, I mentioned before, it's 30% of Republicans who say they believe that true American patriots may have to resort to violence to save the country. But it's the number ticks up slightly for Fox News. Those who most trust Fox News is 32%. But among Republicans who trust most trust far-right news sources, it goes to 40% of Republicans who believe that. So you can see you know just this effect right there and basic facts about the country, belief in violence. And then the other place it really shows up is among this idea about whether America is kind of under threat. Right. And I think this is kind of goes to our larger conversation. This idea that America, you know, has some identity that is essentially some version of a white Christian America, and that version of America is in danger of losing its culture and identity. So we asked in this last survey whether people believe that America is in danger of losing its cultural and identity. Now, only a third of Democrats agree with this, but 80% of Republicans agree with that statement. And again, if you look at those who look at Republicans who most trust Fox News, it rises to 89%. And if you look at Republicans who most trust far-right news outlets, it goes to nearly all of them, 98%. So you can clearly see, you know, just this influence and really these toward just the most extreme views because it's a steady diet of those ideas being, you know, out there on these networks.
Oh, it's really disappointing. Pettis?
Yeah, it sounds like we're having a white identity crisis, and you know that we need to put this on the couch and try to figure out ways to help them, you know, through this process. And I talk to people in my own circles who've had to deal with their own identity crises. But one of the things about identity crises, when you think about it from a therapeutic perspective, is that whatever trauma people are going through will help them on the other side to become much wiser and to learn from the experience. So it's really about how people approach their crises, if you will. You speak a little bit. I don't know if you want to say anything about that.
No, I'd love to, actually. I think that's dead on. I mean, so in the latest book, White Too Long, you know, I end the book with a very similar point. And because I think what we're seeing really is this kind of great freak out. Among, and I would say it's really a white Christian identity crisis. And that's, to me, I think important to remember, you know, groups like the KKK, I think, are often, you know, remembered, and kind of their second rise in the 1920s, early 20th century, are often thought of as just being a kind of anti-black white supremacist organization. But it's worth remembering, they actually had this vision. What was really animating them was a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant Christian view of the country, which explains why, for example, they were also anti-Catholic and anti-Jewish, right, anti-Semitic. And that's because they saw Catholics and Jews, along with non-European non-European Protestants, as diluting this culture of white Anglo-Saxon Protestantism. And I think that idea, you know, is remarkably alive 100 years later. You know, we're seeing it very frequent now, not just on the fringes, but even from some of our sitting members of Congress, language that talks about a kind of replacement theory, right, of kind of replacing true Americans. And, you know, you start asking, well, who are true Americans? Well, they're white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, you know, is who those people have in mind when they say that. So I think it's, but I think that your bigger point here is that this is exactly right. I mean, I think a lot of kind of white Christians, some of the times when I'm speaking in churches and other places, there is a kind of defensiveness that kicks in, you know, that I think is important to kind of sit with and kind of let it pass in a way, because I think in many ways we are in a kind of, you know, fever that is, and that piece I wrote, you know, about the unmaking of the white Christian worldview, the subtitle to that piece was, you know, as white Christians are losing their world, many are losing their minds. And the reason for that is I think we're in this kind of feverish, you know, kind of flailing around that is a kind of fit. And it is a kind of last gasp, I think. But I think the thing to do is to hopefully, you know, we can sit till the fever breaks, come to a more sane place. And then I think that the thing that we realize on the other side is that, yeah, we're all better off if we can do that. I mean, it's a fundamentally anti-democratic belief to believe that the country is destined to be a white Christian country. That is a fundamentally anti-democratic belief, right? And so if we're going to find ourselves living in a healthy democracy, and I would also add, by the way, as someone who still considers himself Christian, if we're going to find ourselves with a healthy faith, this is a fever that's going to have to break. And I think when it does, we're going to realize that we're all the better for it.
Well, I love the phrase, the great freak out. you know, I would like your opinion and on QAnon. Are they a tragedy, a danger, or a terrorist group? I can make an argument for all three. I mean, just this past Tuesday, there were hundreds in Dallas believing John was going to be coming back and at 12:29 p.m., and I consider that a tragedy for those people that they believe things like that. And I believe it's a danger because one believer's already murdered two of his children, saying that they had serpent DNA. And then and terrorists, you know, a significant number of QAnon followers, according to NBC's news reporter Ben Collins, believe the endpoint of their religion will be attained when Donald Trump takes back control of America and unleashes police to mass arrest elected and other high-profile Democrats, and QAnon followers then will engage in an orgy of violence and murder against Democratic Party, aligned neighbors and friends and family who they believe drink the blood and are satanic pedophiles. I mean, it just seems like all three, but that's my opinion. What's yours?
Yeah, well, you know, we have actually tried to measure QAnon, which is something quite difficult, as you might imagine, because it's a very slippery phenomenon. But we actually spent some time, more time than I really wanted to, on QAnon channels, listening to the language, trying to get the vernacular right, because we wanted to basically ask some questions that use that vernacular. And we ended up with three questions that we use to kind of get the core tenets of the QAnon movement. So one of them is this idea that there's a storm coming soon that will sweep away the elites and powers and restore the rightful leaders. Is a kind of, as you were describing this thing in Dallas, a kind of apocalyptic, you know, vision, kind of end times where suddenly things are going to shift. And the second one, you know, is it comes down to a survey question I really never thought I would write as a social scientist. I mean, we all kind of stared at it on the page, but here it goes, right? This statement, the government, media, and financial worlds in the U.S. are controlled by a group of Satan-worshipping pedophiles who run a global sex trafficking operation. 18% of the country agrees with that statement. And then the last one was the one that we've mentioned about violence, and 18% of the country overall says that. But you put all those things together, and it's remarkable that we put them together in a scale, and it's 17% of Americans that even if you put all three of those things together and say you have to agree with all three of those things, 17% of Americans we dubbed QAnon believers who agree with all three of those statements. And again, if you look at Republicans, it jumps to 26% of Republicans. It's 23% of white evangelical Protestants. So, you know, again, it's a quarter of a major political party. It's a quarter of a mainstream religion. And again, though, I kind of do go back to, you know, this unmaking of the white Christian worldview. And you know, you ask, well, how could somebody believe these crazy statements, and how can somebody believe that an election was stolen from, you know, but I do think it comes down to this, that if you had this fundamental unshakable belief that the country belonged to you, right, as a white Christian, and that belief has suddenly been shattered you know, over the last, you know, decade or so, as the country's really shifted and crossed this line from no longer be a majority white Christian country, and there's all kinds of signs that shift is going to continue. It does kind of open you up to believing other kinds of really irrational, unfounded things, particularly if you think those beliefs are going to take you back to this assurance of something that you always found. And I really do think at the end of the day, it comes down to that America was a promised land for white Christians. And that belief is the belief that's being shattered and is really, I think, opening people up to all kinds of other conspiracy theories as that fundamental piece of their worldview has come apart.
Well, even QAnon himself back in December 18, 2018 said that John was dead. I don't know how John got involved in all of this, but Pettis, you have a question?
Yeah. You spoke a bit about Eddie Gloud and in coming to grips with his view. Can you talk a little bit more about, you know, a much narrower definition of white supremacy that...
Yeah.
And I mean, before you get to that, one of the issues I have is the fact that we have to make it easy for people who have inflicted a lot of pain on other people. But that aside, can you talk a little bit more about the Eddie Gloud situation and your thoughts?
Yeah. So Eddie's a friend. He's also an amazing scholar, Princeton kind of endowed chair professor, former president of the American Academy of Religion. Just a little brief side note. He and I are both from Mississippi. And we actually ran against each other for the governorship of the Mississippi State Youth Legislature in 1985. And he kicked my ass in that election and went on to become the first African-American elected governor of the Mississippi Youth Legislature. So we go way, way back. But I've been such an admirer of his work and have learned so much from him. And he had this way of talking about white supremacy that I found helpful, I think, for white people. And he just boiled it down and said, look, what we really need is a way to think about white supremacy without all the bluster, is the way he put it, in Democracy in Black and White, his book, Democracy in Black and White. And, you know, what I think happens for many white people, including me, I should say, you know, growing up, is that when I heard the word white supremacy, I immediately conjured up in my head this black and white kind of aged, maybe yellowing photo of some Klan people burning a cross, right? But the photo's faded, it's black and white, it's kind of, you know, grainy. And I think that's what most white people do, right? And the reason why that's convenient is that it puts it very far from your own experience if you're white. So, you know, something that's back in the 1920s has very little to do with today. But I think kind of boiling it down to, again, this belief that white lives are to be valued more than others, and that white people are to have access to better things than others. And when you put it that way, there's really no doubt that our entire history in this country has been constructed that way. I mean, you know, who you could marry, where you could live, what kind of job you could get, what the likelihood would be if you did something wrong that you would either be killed while being arrested or go to jail rather than being put on a lighter sentence or probation. All of these things heavily structured by race, and, you know, and until not that long ago, I mean, you know, could you go to the public library? Could you swim in the community pool? You know, just very basic things, and you know, whites only neighborhoods in the best places in the city, places for non-whites near kind of industrial centers and flood zones, like that kind of thing. I mean, it was very, very explicit. And so I think we take that seriously. I mean, even today, I mean, there are cities. I mean, I'm in Washington, D.C. So here in D.C. and Baltimore nearby, there are zip codes, you know, that are 3 miles apart. And the life expectancy in one that's predominantly white, one that's predominantly African-American, might be 20 years difference.
Wow.
Just by what zip code you happen to be born into. But these were, you still see that legacy today. And so I think this kind of taking this white supremacy without all the bluster and bringing it home to us so that it doesn't exist in some, you know, thing that we can just think about as something distant, but something that still has a claim on us today, I think is really important. And again, not important for any external reason, but I think for whites and white Christians in particular, this is important for our own health, really for the health of our own psyches, the health of our own churches. It's not for other people. It's really for us, to get our heads straight, you know, as they say growing up or to put it theologically. I mean, this is really, you know, what's at stake is theologically speaking is really what we would call our souls.
Wow. That's so well said. We're speaking with author Robert P. Jones, and you're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Want a friend to hear this interview? Be Bold America is available as a podcast. Now they can listen for free on their favorite podcast platforms such as Apple, Google, Radio Public, Spotify, and many others. I'm your host, Jill Cody. What can you do to reunite this country and save our democracy? These heady issues will be discussed on KSQD 90.7 FM, Be Bold America. Be Bold America is a live bi-weekly talk show for those who are motivated to step out of their daily routine. On Be Bold America, we will be discussing what you can keep doing, stop doing, and start doing to take action. We have big things to do. Every other Sunday at 5 p.m. on K-Squid, community radio for the Monterey Bay. Well, I wonder who that was. Today, our topic is the end of white Christian America, and we're speaking to Robert P. Jones, who writes regularly on politics, culture, and religion for The Atlantic Online, NBC Think, and other outlets. Learn more about Robert and PRRI at PRRI.org. Robert, before we have a few minutes left. Before we start talking about what listeners can keep doing, stop doing, and start doing to support and advance your work, is there anything else you wanted to cover?
No, I think we've done a great job. No,
yay.
Thanks for all the, fantastic questions.
Oh, good. So in these last few minutes, what can listeners do with the topics that we've been talking about and what your goals are as an organization? What can listeners keep doing, stop doing, or start doing?
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, I'm going to answer this for, you know, I think of as an answer for white people first. You know, I think for people who grew up thinking of themselves as white or understand themselves as white, to really, you know, take some time to try to just unpack this. I think the tendency is to, you know, hear the word white supremacy, recoil. There's just a kind of defensiveness. And I think that the plea would be to say, like, what I say over and over is to just sit with it, right? To not dismiss it. If you find defensiveness kind of welling up when you hear something about Black Lives Matter or critical race theory or these other kind of hot button things that are around our political debates, rather than just kind of having it bounce off, you know, ask the question, like, why is it that I'm defensive about this? What's going on in me? And the other thing I would say is, you know, we've got to build some relationships across lines of race and religion. That one of the things we find in our research is this makes more difference than almost anything else. And the truth is today, I mean, the last time we did a big survey of people's social networks, what we found is that the average white person's kind of core friendship network is that the people that they really talk about their lives and problems in their lives, and like we asked them to name people they talked to about important things in their life over the last 12 months. And that circle, the average white person's circle is 93% white. And 75% of white Americans say they have not a single person of color in their friendship networks. And, you know, if you really want to get a handle on some of this, you know, you got to get out of an echo chamber where, you know, when you say something and somebody will kind of go, well, wait a minute, you know, let's talk about that, right? That assumption you've got working there. I think for white Christians, I would say the easiest place to start is to start local. Get out of your head and ask some questions like about church. So I'll just give one more quick answer here. I think if every white Christian in the country would ask the question, why is our church physically located in the community where it is located? That question gets very quickly to issues of race. Most people don't think it does, but it almost certainly does. If it's an older church, it's probably in a whites-only, a previous area of the community that was designated whites-only. And even if it's a newer church, I think many times what has happened is it's out in the suburbs where it followed white flight. From inner cities to the suburbs out there, and is part of that history of segregation and protecting kind of whites only spaces. Yeah, I would say these are really, really important questions. And if you kind of start there and start telling stories, you know, I think that's the other thing. Be honest and tell some stories. I think these things will come to light, and it's a place to start. I think a foothold is like really important.
I also think it's important for people to answer for themselves, what is it to be an American? I don't know if people really think about about that, answering that question for themselves. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, we actually asked this question, and we have, again, some huge divides in the country over what people think about that. And there's a lot of agreement on some basic things. But for example, on the question of whether you need to be Christian or not, there's a huge partisan divide on that question. 63% of Republicans, but only 35% of Democrats, for example, say that being Christian is important to be quote unquote truly American. So again, I mean, this is not something really that our country was founded on. So the good news is it's 43% of the country, so it's less than half. But there is this huge partisan divide on this question. So I think you're exactly right. Like, getting straight on that question and aligning our answers with that question around the constitutional principles of, I mean, George Washington was very clear about this when he was asked by a synagogue early on whether they were going to be second-class citizens because they weren't Christian. And Washington replied very strongly, no, that this was not the case, and that you only had to kind of uphold democratic values. And that was the end of it. And so I think remembering that, today is you know, we're still kind of struggling over that idea.
I'm so glad you brought up the Founding Fathers, because they were definitely had the position that they weren't starting a Christian nation, correct?
Right. Yeah. No, that's right.
Yeah. Pettus, in the last 2 minutes, any comment or something you want to add?
Just that this has been a very fascinating conversation with you, Robert. Mm-hmm. It's been a great history lesson. You reminded me of some things that I had forgotten. And so I'm very thankful for that. You spoke about what you might say to fellow whites. What would you say to people who are people of color about what we might be able to do?
Thank you for your patience. unbelievable. Yes. Unbelievable patience. I mean, I think here of Baldwin, James Baldwin, who I, you know, I think was so instrumental in my own thinking. But I think in Christianity, that African-American Christianity is held on to, like the liberation tradition in ways that white Christians have forgotten. In many ways, I think African-Americans have held on to democratic traditions that like basic voting rights that many white Christians have forgotten. So, you know, I think a kind of gratitude for holding on to those principles in ways that we might still retrieve them. I think for really undeserved patience, I would say, over just so many opportunities that have been blown throughout our history. I mean, many historians are talking about this as the third Reconstruction, and we've had at least two other major opportunities where the time was right to finally put white supremacy in the grave, and we haven't done it. And I am hoping, I mean, it was a good place to end. I am hopeful, and even more hopeful than when I finished the White Too Long, that to take James Baldwin's words here, that we will finally end the racial nightmare and achieve our country and change the history of the world.
Oh, that's wonderful words. That's beautiful. Robert Pettus and I really enjoyed this conversation. I wish we had more time, and I hope you'll come back one day. Thank you for being our bold and impressive guest. We appreciate you and all that the Public Religion Research Institute does and the data that you provide us every year. I'm sure it's a lot of work, so thank you for that.
Oh, thank you. And just one other thing I'll mention.
Yes.
If people want to follow along weekly, I am writing a new Substack. It's robertpjones.substack.com. Where I'm writing on these issues at the intersection of religion, racial justice, and politics.
Oh, I didn't know that, so I'm so glad you mentioned that. Up next on Be Bold America, Sunday, November 21st at 5 p.m., will be The Post Office is Under Attack, and Why Does Louis DeJoy Want to Destroy It? We'll be speaking with Porter McConnell, who is co-founder of the Save the Post Office Coalition and campaign director for Take on Wall Street. Porter will bring us up to date on the condition of our U.S. postal system, tell us why on earth is Louis DeJoy still Postmaster General, and how he continues to sabotage this constitutionally delineated service that we all love. So join us on Sunday, November 21st at 5 p.m. to hear The Post Office is Under Attack and Why Does Louis DeJoy Want to Destroy It? Remember, Be Bold America is available as a podcast. Now you can listen to the show anytime for free, wherever you get your podcasts. And I want to give a special thank you to Be Bold America's program engineer, Emily Donham, and to our program director, Howard Feldstein, and to our bold guest again, Robert P. Jones. You're listening to KSQD Santa Cruz, many voices, one station. Listen worldwide online on ksqd.org. Stay tuned for State of Mind. My name is Jill Cody.
And I'm Dr. Pettus Perry.
And thank you for listening to Be Bold America. Until next time, keep, stop, start.